Welcome in to the 48 Minutes Podcast on Believe, presented by Bet Online. I'm Ross Geiger, the former NBA video coordinator, having spent time with the Bucks, Suns, and Knicks. And I'm joined alongside Bruce Bernstein, our four-time Emmy Award winner, who spent more than three decades at ESPN producing NBA shows, SportsCenter, and soaking up knowledge from the best hoop analysts in the business. And we're also joined by two-time Emmy Award winner Michael World B. Freer, who is a senior stat writer at Stat Factor, specializing in writing advanced statistical NBA reports for various announcers across the league. This is episode number 99, the Jay Crowder episode, as the former Marquette Golden Eagle has notoriously worn number 99 throughout his entire 12-year NBA career, with just one exception, as he wore number 9 in his early years as a member of the Dallas Mavericks. Before we get into tonight's discussion, just a quick reminder, BetOnline is your number one source for all your summer sports this season. From MLB, golf, NBA, and NHL playoffs, stats, all the latest stats, news, and scores available to follow your favorite teams. Get the latest odds and lines, including the latest team matchups, player props, and odds on just about every sport out there. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to get in on the action. BetOnline, where the game starts. And fellas, I think there's no better place to start than the epic game two matchup we just saw at Madison Square Garden between the Philadelphia 76ers and New York Knicks. And World B, I'll start with you. It looked like those Knicks really stole one down the stretch. They're battling back and getting their hands on some loose balls, leading to that big three-pointer by DiVincenzo.
Yeah, it was another really good game. Game one was an exciting game too, really. You know, Knicks kind of took control a little bit in the fourth quarter, but it was a tight game throughout. Game two, much the same. They had it was much the same. Philly jumped out to a nice lead, and New York had to battle their way back. But, yeah, the end of the game, Philly played so much better. We were talking before we went on about how much better Philly did on the boards this time around as opposed to game one. They got destroyed on the boards in game one. This time around, they did much better, much more competitive on the boards, really cut into the advantage in second-chance points. But, man, they need to come up with that one rebound at the end of the game, and they had it, and it still got away from them. And, yeah, it left the Knicks open for if you want to say they stole one, that's fine. There no takebacks for Knicks fans.
Yeah, exactly. And, Bruce, we were also talking throughout the end there and had some questions in regards to Joel Embiid not getting a shot there. What would you like to see down the stretch there from Joel? I mean, obviously he kind of had to take that last second three with like 0.4 seconds left on the clock, and that didn't go through. But wouldn't you have liked to see him get a post up or maybe a catch around the elbow area and try to draw at least a foul?
I mean, on that second to last possession when they were only down two, we were screaming, like, because they came out of a timeout and there was, what, like 11 or 12 seconds left. I don't remember exactly. It's like, first of all, Joel Embiid has been laboring for this whole series with that knee. So why not get him as close to the basket as you can, get the ball in, get a pass to him. 11 seconds is an eternity. All right. Although he did miss four free throws in the first half tonight, he's a deadly free throw shooter. I would say get Joel the ball in the post. One head fake, two head fakes, and if they don't go for it, a third head fake, and you're getting fouled on that third head fake, and now you're going to the line to tie the game. It was not at all what I expected to see from Nick Nurse.
Not at all, and the benefit there goes to the New York Knicks and their hungry crowd in this one. Will be, as far as the Knicks are concerned, obviously you got to be thrilled to be up 2-0, but what do you think has been the big difference maker so far in this series when it comes to why the Knicks have been able to, you know, down the stretch execute and win these ball games rather than fall short like the Sixers?
A couple of things. One, they've had other guys step up besides their star, Jalen Brunson. Brunson has really, you know, except for the 1-3 he made at the end of the game, which bounced off and in, which if you want to say it was a lucky bounce, that's fine. But, I mean, you know, if you take the series as a whole, he's really struggled right now. Two for 12 on threes in this series. He's really struggling. But they've had other guys. Josh Hart gets 20 points and at least 20 points in each of the first two games. Miles McBride was a big star in game one. And in game two, Dante DiVincenzo, who's, you know, been a super player all season for them. He stepped up. So they're getting play from other guys, you know, offensively. And the other thing is, this is a deep, now that they're healthy again, this is a deep Knicks team. They only played 8 guys so far in the series. They've only, their bench has only been Bogdanovich and Robinson and McBride. But they're a deep team. Those are quality players coming off the bench for them. And that's a big thing they didn't have for a good stretch of the season when they had so many injuries.
You know, back when Tommy Heinsohn was doing Celtics games, he used to give out these things called Tommy points, which were basically, you know, kind of pats on the back for just winning plays that weren't necessarily, you know, a three-pointer or a dunk or whatever. Well, Isaiah Hartenstein is like collecting Tommy points at the wazoo, particularly in the third quarter on Monday night when he had 10 points. And then down the stretch, I mean, when he, you know, kept that offensive rebound alive, I mean, he had 14 points, 7 out of 8 from the floor, okay? 14 points, 8 rebounds, 4 assists, and 3 blocks. And he's your, you know, backup center. I was telling you guys, I was getting some Steven Adams feels watching him a little bit, you know. But I mean, Isaiah Hartenstein is somebody that absolutely deserves major credit, not only for those numbers, but for kind of playing Embiid kind of physical and making him a little uncomfortable too.
So Bruce, real quick here, can't we still call them Tommy points? Just Tommy Thibodeau points?
There you go. I got nothing to add, Ross. You got it.
Yeah. By the way, real quick, we focus on the Knicks here because I'm the Knicks fan and everything like that. We talked about the Sixers on the last play and we questioned that, but MD's really been amazing here. He's doing it on one leg and he's really putting up some numbers on one leg. It's tough to watch. As if you're being objective, it's tough to watch and get up and down the court sometimes. He's really struggling. He's gutting it out and still putting the ball in the basket and being a real tough matchup. So I got a lot of respect for him, the way he's playing and whatever. And Maxey has been solid for 2 games, but they're really not getting much help outside of those 2.
Yeah, not at all. And it's been fun to watch the game within the game in this series as well. I know we obviously talked off the air about Dante DiVincenzo, obviously kind of baiting Joel Embiid into pushing him back and getting a technical foul there on the foul call on Embiid. And that was a 3-point play where Dante was smiling at the line, knowing exactly what he was doing there. And then on the other end, of course, we got Kyle Lowry, who, Bruce, I don't know. I don't want to steal your thunder here, but who did you compare him to?
he's got a little bit of Chris Paul. He's got a little bit of John Stockton, you know, undersized guys who were kind of nice, clean-cut looking guys that were dirty as whatever.
Yep. Yeah. Well, it should be interesting as this series now shifts to the city of brotherly love, because as we know, the Philly fans can be quite hostile as well, and that's a tough place to play. I mean, as far as my own experience in the league, never played a playoff game there, but every regular season game that I ever stepped foot in that building was a tough one. It's a tough place to win, and obviously the Sixers have some work to do being down 0-2. So looking forward to game 3 and seeing where this one goes. But I don't know if I've ever seen the Knicks fans as energized as they were tonight. I know you guys probably have in the 90s, but that building was quite loud there tonight throughout the whole game.
They're feeling themselves, no doubt about it. I mean, you know, it's been 51 years since they won a championship. So, you know, there's that.
This is as good a team as they've had since their last finals appearance. Let's call it what it was. About 12 years ago, they had a good one with Carmelo and some of the other veterans. This is probably the best team they've had since they made the championship in 99, made the finals. That's 25 years. So, yeah, there's a lot of frustration and built up over that time for Knicks fans to come out and let it loose tonight in this series, I guess.
The other night they were saying, we want Boston, we want Boston. Maybe they'll get their wish.
They might. And moving right along here, we had another game go final at the time of taping tonight, and that was the Magic-Cavs game, as the Cavs now move ahead 2-0 in that series, taking care of business at home against the Orlando Magic in the first 2 games of this series. And World B, I'm going to spoil you tonight and ask you the first question once again, because the Magic are your team. And If I had told you, World B, that the Magic would not crack 90 points in each of their first two games against the Cavs, what would you tell me?
It would surprise me. It wouldn't have shocked me. Okay. What surprises me is that they just haven't – it's really been as bad as they you expect them to be offensively sometimes. It's been even worse. There's just – the way I'm looking at it, there's no way – you should be able to win playoff games or playoff series when you're shooting less than 30% from three-point range, unless you're the Cleveland Cavaliers, which that's what they're doing right now, and you're playing the Orlando Magic. That's the only way you can get away with this, because Orlando's just – they look like two games in, not ready, not built for postseason play. This is not their time yet. They're playing – I don't want to say playing scared or whatever, but they're just not ready for this moment. It's pretty clear at this point. They're not ready for to be a playoff team. They had a good record, but series isn't over. You got to come to Orlando, but if they don't step up their offense, it will be over.
And, Bruce, do you think that the Orlando Magic back home can make this series interesting, or is the writing on the wall for how this one's going to play out?
I didn't look at their statistics for the season on what their shooting percentage was at home versus on the road, but I haven't seen as many bricks in the first two games since I watched the Construction Channel. Okay. they shot 36% on Monday night, 26% on threes. Once again, their guards were totally dominated by Cleveland's guards, which was what I kind of said going in last week, that to me, I thought it was a big difference between Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland versus Jalen Suggs and Gary Harris. Tonight, it was 38-23. It was better than it was for Orlando in game one, but it was still pretty bad. But really, if you look at it, I think the guy who was the real difference maker for Cleveland in game two was Jared Allen. I mean, I've been a huge fan of Jared Allen for years. 16 points on like 10 field goal attempts, 20 rebounds, 2 block shots. And Mobley, you know, did a good job too. So I had thought this was going to be Cavs in 7. It might be more like Cavs in 5.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And we'll be, as we're kind of just searching here, trying to help the Orlando Magic as best we can. As far as adjustments are concerned, one thing that I had thought of was, would you entertain starting Wendell Carter and just getting even bigger? Maybe even trying to go zone with just a bunch of big guys, since that is one of the strong suits of this team and the guard play has really just not been there in the first two games of this series. I mean, I understand Wendell Carter Jr. shot 1 of 6 from 3 today, but we're soul searching here. I mean, what kind of adjustments would you make if you're Orlando?
Well, a couple of things here. 1 of 6 represents the best shooting, perimeter shooting by a Mavs Magic player off the bench tonight. So congratulations to Wendell Carter for that. And Bruce mentioned they shot 26% from 3-point range in game two. By the way, that's an improvement from game one. So congratulations to Orlando for that. It's very simple. They got to make some sort of move. I would entertain the idea of putting Mo Wagner in the starting lineup and at least getting a little more muscle, a little more physicality. Not that Jonathan Isaac can't do that. Not that Wendell Carter Jr. can't do it. Wendell Carter Jr. was a starter for most of this runs, and he's been healthy. And you know, I think after the All-Star break, this is when they had their lineup of Suggs and Harris, Carter, Banchero, and Franz Wagner. They were like 14-2 or 14-3 after the All-Star break when they were all in the lineup. That was a really good lineup. And now that you know they put in Isaac at the starting lineup, I'm not crazy about that. But at the end of the day, it's really simple for Orlando. They have to shoot the ball. Their defense has not been bad. They've held Cleveland under 100 points for two games, and they've gotten blown out. I mean, that's just – how do you hold a team under in this day and age under 100 points in two games, and you're not in the game at all? They haven't had the lead once in 96 minutes of playoff ball. It's unbelievable. That's so hard to do. You can get up 2-0 and still have a lead, but they haven't had a lead once. If they don't shoot better, it's a 4-game sweep. If they shoot the ball a little bit better, not a lot better, although a lot better would be helpful for them, a little bit better, they can be in some of these games. They can come back to Cleveland with a, you know, a shot at continuing the series. Otherwise, it's two games in Orlando and done if they can't shoot better than this.
Hey, Ross, last week you dubbed this series the NBA TV series because yeah. Nobody wants to watch any of these games on TNT or ESPN. And I think games one and two, you were very, very prescient.
Yeah,
I think spot game on. I think game three is NBA TV too, if I'm not mistaken. And yep. Game four is a 1 o'clock start on Saturday, you know, the first game of the day. They're trying to get the what's the one that lose the least amount of damage? Put them on then. That's and the series is living up to the billing, if nothing else. We can at least say that.
Yeah, no, they are living up to its name as the NBA TV series. So enough about a game between the Cleveland and Orlando where we didn't even have one player score 35 points in the entire game. Let's get to the series where we had a guy drop 35 points in one half, and that is the Indiana-Milwaukee series as we saw playoff Dame go nuclear, scoring 35 points in the first half. Meanwhile, Tyrese Haliburton still looks like a shell of himself, which was a cause for concern for Pacer fans. Bucks are up 1-0 in this series. Bruce, I'll start with you. What was your overall reaction just watching that one take place?
Well, I think we saw peak Dame on Sunday night. I mean, that was Dame. That was the best you could play at that position, what Dame Lillard did in the first half of that game. He had basically destroyed Indiana's will to live by halftime.
Yeah.
I mean, he really did. I don't know how his game is going to change when Giannis comes back, but based on what I've seen, I would say, you know what? Take another game. You know, they're thinking, should we play him? Should we not play him? I mean, Dame was just ridiculous without him. But you want to hear a really screwed up number about Dame's game on Sunday night? Okay. Weirdly, all right, he had the worst plus minus of all the Bucks starters. He was minus six. Okay.
Wow.
So what I would say to my buddy Michael World B. Freer is that sometimes the numbers do lie.
Absolutely. I don't care what the numbers are, truthful or not, as long as they're accurate.
And World B, obviously one of the big bright spots for the Bucks outside of Dame was the play of Chris Middleton. Played 34 minutes, had 23 points on an efficient 9-of-14 shooting. I mean, seeing him kind of evolve here come playoff time, really running up and down the floor, looking real nice as well. I mean, if they can get Giannis back, are they back in business to being a legitimate contender in the NBA?
I absolutely think so. It's hard. The way they finish the season makes it hard to envision that, but with those three in there, they're a dominant group. And I've mentioned to you guys before that lineup that they have when they start Middleton and Giannis and Lopez and Lillard and Beverly, you know, that group that's in there, they can, that starting five matches up with Boston's starting five by the numbers. The efficiency on both ends is really interesting. It's really interesting. They played about the same number of minutes, and they've been pretty good that way. So I'm not going to count them out just yet as far as, you know, being title contender the way they finished. Middleton has been great. When he's on his mid-range game, he's really, really tough to defend, and he hit 6 out of 7 from mid-range in game one. He's a problem for them, especially since Indiana treats defense like the measles sometimes. Don't get near it.
Yeah. Well, you know, both Middleton and Portis both had double-doubles in that game, okay? And Pat Bev is another Tommy Point sort of a guy in a lot of ways. He, in game number one, he had 7 rebounds, 8 assists, 1 turnover. And we know what kind of a dog he is on defense, okay? Oh, yeah. So, I mean, since he's been there, I mean, if they get the whole band together soon and Giannis is able to do, you know, Giannis things quickly – I mean, you don't want to play that team. Nobody wants that smoke.
Nope. And, so obviously you guys know I was very pleased with that game one outcome for Milwaukee. But I'll be honest, I'm taking this game with a grain of salt. Yes, it was great to see Dame provide such an epic shooting performance in the first half. But Much like my concerns post All-Star weekend, which I did allude to on this show, could all of Dame's success in game one just be another big tease for Bucks fans? That's still yet to be determined here. And while I don't really want to focus too much on the negative with this team right now, being up 1-0 with a nice performance at home, I want to quickly pivot here to the gigantic positive, and that is with Giannis. This Bucks game one victory just bought Giannis a couple more days of rest, recovery, and evaluation. So with this team up 1-0 in the series, I think we now see Giannis make his earliest appearance in game four. That's what I'm now projecting. That would be what would be a worst case scenario, because if it's game four, I see the Bucks being down 1-2 in this series and Giannis trying to rush back. But honestly, that's the huge takeaway for me with this game. The more time Giannis has to recover, the better. I would not rush him back for the first game, game three in Indiana, just because I think it has to be very strategic when he comes back with such a tender injury to his calf with the calf strain. I mean, once you bring him back, I mean, you got to make sure he can last until game seven of the NBA finals. I know the way Giannis looks at it when he's looking at his schedule and like how many games can my body withstand stuff. He's for sure keeping into consideration game seven of the NBA finals. Now that might sound crazy, but that's just the way he ticks. And I think you delay this as much as possible and ride with the guys you have. And again, I mean, Bruce, I'm sure you would agree with this as well. Like bringing Giannis back somewhere in the middle of this series could also maybe throw these guys for a loop and kind of throw them off their game a little bit. Wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, you know, in the five games this year, Giannis averaged 42 points and 13 rebounds against those guys. He had, 64 in the famous, game ball game. By the way, Oscar Tshiebwe was a DNP in game one.
nice.
If you know. I know you guys know. I don't know if anybody listening knows, but, go ahead and Google Oscar Tshiebwe. Anyway, yes, I think that should be a concern for Lillard, right? Because Lillard had daddy gave him permission to take the car out and drive it as fast as he wanted to in game one. When Giannis is back, he might have to play more in second gear than in fourth, and we'll see if that inhibits his effectiveness.
Yep, so we'll have to keep an eye on that. Another fun series to watch. Now, heading to the Western Conference, talk about fun. We had a great one between the New Orleans Pelicans and the Oklahoma City Thunder. And undoubtedly, this was the most competitive round one, game one matchup of this past weekend. So while the Thunder hold the 1-0 lead, New Orleans certainly can make this first round matchup very, very interesting. Wouldn't you say, Will B?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're New Orleans, you are looking at the box score and you're going, all right, we didn't shoot 40% from this game. We shot under 30% from 3-point range, and we were right there at the end. We had the lead right in the closing seconds. So, and we're obviously playing without one of our big three there in Zion. We absolutely can win this game. It was not the game, the greatest game from an offensive standpoint, like we were, you might expect with these two teams, or certainly with Oklahoma City, the way they can get up and down the court and put it in the basket. But yeah, if I'm New Orleans, I was like, all right, we had a really good shot, couldn't get there. Look at our numbers. We can only improve.
Yep.
Oklahoma City is a really good defense, one of the top five defenses in the league, but we can be better than this and be in the game.
Ross, that was really, that game one was really sort of Oklahoma City's welcome to the playoffs, young fellas game, because it was a total grinding game down the stretch. During the final 6 minutes, the score was 9-6 Pelicans, all right? So OKC, couldn't score. The Pelicans weren't exactly lighting it up, but OKC held them off just enough to hang on for that 2-point win. SGA, had the big buckets, 28 points. But Oklahoma City had 6 turnovers in the last 12 minutes of that game, okay? Which shows you that as a young team facing the kind of pressure in the playoffs, and, oh, by the way, a really tough-minded New Orleans team, as you guys said, even though they're shorthanded, these are like manly men out there. I mean, they give you no quarter. I mean, they're tough. And I think, it was definitely welcome to the playoffs for OKC. We'll see what happens from here.
Yeah, I mean, the Pelicans, even without Zion, match up extremely well with those talented wings on Oklahoma City. Trey Murphy III, Herb Jones, Brandon Ingram, their size, length, athleticism, that's all the strengths that Oklahoma City has as an offense is concerned. And so going into this defensively, I mean, they're definitely going to have their troubles trying to score against this Pelicans group. And down the stretch, obviously, SGA is going to have to be Superman out there performing in the clutch, which would be huge. Bruce?
Ross, I would like to ask you a question, Ross, as our resident coach. Most playoff coaches, when they get into the playoffs, they'll tighten up their rotation. You know, usually go with around eight guys, you know, depending, you know, what the score of the game is. In game one, which was a one-possession game, Mark Dagno used 11 guys. I mean, from a coaching standpoint, did you find that unusual? You think that's something he'll continue to do, or do you see him possibly tightening up that bench and going with his three best guys, you know, once the starters need a blow?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's certainly unusual. You don't see a lot of teams do that right out of the gates, and certainly kind of give credit to the Pelicans. It looked like Mark Dagnall was looking for ways to really expose them or find advantages within some of that tough defense that they were being shown out there. But if I'm looking at it from a Thunder perspective, you know, everybody on the bench stay ready. You might get called. Maybe that was part of the mentality going into this one. Everyone needs to be ready. Anyone can be called upon at any given time to step in. But very weird to see that, to be quite honest. I mean, I remember when I first saw Kendrick Williams come into the game, I was quite surprised. And then Jalen Williams popped in, and I'm like, wow, they're just bringing out all the tools out of the shed here tonight. So I would be surprised if we see him go that deep in a close game again this series. But, you know, Mark Dagnall's up for Coach of the Year, so I can't really question, you know, his coaching at this time. And with that, let's go ahead and get into our second half. And we're going to start out with Miami and Boston, Bruce. And it was triples trouble for the Heat in Boston. The Celtics weren't just raining in three-pointers to secure the victory in Game 1, but Jason Tatum finished his 2024 playoff debut with a triple-double. So, Bruce, I'll start with you. I mean, nice big win at home in Game 1. What was your reactions and thoughts to what you saw from your C's?
The Heat and the Celtics really do not like each other. I mean, a lot of teams feel that way about Miami, but I think Boston, because they played each other in so many important playoff series over the past few years, they can't stand each other. I mean, that when Caleb Martin had that sort of hit on Tatum, which did not appear intentional, I might say. I mean, I don't think he did that on purpose. But, you know, Jaylen Brown's response right away was fire. I mean, he was ready to go. And that, to me, for Boston, is a great, great sign, because they can be a very soft team at times, okay? And when you're playing against a team like Miami, they are the opposite of a soft team, regardless of how shorthanded they are. They will battle you all the way. And if you remember, you know, Jaylen and Duncan Robinson had a little thing back in February where they got locked up, their arms got locked up, and Jaylen flung him out of bounds, got a flagrant foul, you know. So I thought, you know, as great as Tatum was, I thought Jaylen Brown at the beginning of the game, first two possessions, got them off to a 5-0 start. Then he was kind of quiet in the second quarter when Sam Hauser decided to go all Steph Curry on those guys with like four threes in the second quarter, which really, to me, that his threes were the thing that really created the separation that allowed Boston to really expand that lead. I thought those were huge. And, you know, Tatum, that was one of the most low-key triple-doubles I think I've seen. I mean, it was like, la-di-da-di-da, you know, it was efficient. And then, you know, the gap in talent in this series with no Jimmy Butler and no scary Terry Rozier, the talent gap is too wide for the Heat to overcome, despite getting every bit out of the guys that did play, especially Jaime Jaquez Jr., who I think played great in Game 1.
Yeah, I think I could go forever not seeing Haywood Highsmith shoot another three-pointer. He was 0-4, and he's making the Orlando Magic shooters look good right now. That's how bad it was out up there. So, World B, you actually had texted us after that game and brought up a great point about Boston and something that we do need to monitor moving forward, and that has to do with their fourth quarters.
Yeah, it's you can point to some other reason, whatever reasons you want, their pace of play being possessions per 48 minutes, that metric, it gets over 100. I believe it's 102 in the first quarter, and it gradually goes down each quarter. And this season, during the regular season, the fourth quarter, they had the lowest pace of any team in the league, like 93 possessions per 48 minutes in the fourth quarter. Now, you can attribute some of that to, oh, they have a big lead, there's reserves in there, they slow the game. But you saw it in game one. Miami made a run on them. They didn't, yeah. I don't know, Bruce is our Celtics fan, so I don't know if he ever got to the point where he was going, all right, this is getting serious. But you could see it getting closer and closer and closer, and Boston walking it up constantly. You didn't see that in the first quarter. They pushed it in the first quarter, even if it wasn't a fast break. They were setting up their offense quick. You didn't see that in the fourth quarter. They're just, as Miami's going on a run, Miami thought they were still in the game, and they, you know, with every reason, because they have that kind of heart, they have that kind of determination. Boston just dribbling it slowly up the court, no sense of urgency. And I'm not saying they needed to play with urgency, but you have to do a little better than that. And it's a problem for them, if not this series, going forward. This is not just a one-to-two-time thing. We saw it in – Bruce knows. They blew a lot of leads here this season, including one a few weeks ago to the Hawks, which people say wasn't a big deal because they already had everything wrapped up. You blow a 31-point lead. You've blown a 31-point lead. There's no hiding that. This is a potential problem for them.
They did the same thing against Cleveland earlier in the year. They had, you know, the night that Dean Wade came off the bench and looked more like Dwayne Wade than Dean Wade. He just took him down. But I 100% agree with you, because here's the thing. One of the reasons they're such a good three-point shooting team is that they have a lot of good ball movement. They swing the ball around. And when you're playing with pace, that's how you play. When you're playing slow down, you're not whipping the ball around as much. So the pace, when they slow the pace down, it's almost like an NFL team that's got an 8-point lead with 3 minutes left. They're just running the ball, try and milk the clock. And a lot of times that's when somebody fumbles, right? So,
and that puts a lot of pressure on you to make those shots. If you don't have as many possessions, those possessions you have to score. And when you don't, like Boston didn't in that fourth quarter for a time, it gives the other team an opportunity. But the thing I took away from this game, the biggest thing, and it's not a big surprise, we talked about in the preseason when they made the trade for Porzingis and Marcus Smart left, this was now a team that was totally all in on the three-pointer. We're just going to shoot the three and take our chances that way. They proved it during the regular season. No team had a higher percentage of their field goal attempts from three than the Celtics. No team depended on more, got more scoring from three than the Celtics. In this game, 60% of their field goal attempts came from three-point range, 49 threes. Now, they made a bunch of them, and they have throughout the season, so there's no reason to stop doing that. But that's what they were doing, and it worked in game one, and I don't think there's any reason for them to stop it.
No. Just something to monitor moving forward in some of these first-round series matchups against the Heat when things kind of get out of hand early. That'll be something fun to continue to monitor as we continue to watch the game. So wanted to be sure you pointed that out. That was well observed there, Will B. Now, let's shift over and finish off with everything out west. And we'll start with Dallas and the Los Angeles Clippers. And in that one, game one, no Kawhi, no problem. As the Clippers coast to a game one victory at home over the Mavericks, which included an impressive second quarter in which the Clippers held the Mavericks to just 8 total points for the entire quarter. Bruce, where was Dallas? Did they forget this was a playoff game?
Well, this game was an example of why I had always sort of been skeptical of Dallas's legitimacy, even though I did admit late in the season that I was wrong. But Kyrie and Luka combined for 64 points. The rest of the team combined for 33 points. Okay. Those two are so dominant in game one, there was little room for other guys to flourish. And you need to take a little heat off of these two guys by getting these other guys in on the action. Now, Luka did have a bunch of assists, but, you know, I mean, although he didn't score as many points, I thought James Harden played better than both of them. I mean, he had 28 points on just 17 shots. He had 8 assists, just 1 turnover, 6 out of 10 on threes. So, And again, Zubats absolutely dominated Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford. I mean, he had 20 points, 15 boards, a steal, a block. And Russell Westbrook come off the bench for 23 minutes, give him 13, 4, and 4. So with no Kawhi, that was a really nice, comfortable win. I mean, they had a big lead in the game, and they kind of coasted. We'll see if they can make it two in a row. But, yeah, I mean, Luka and Kyrie can't score two-thirds of the team's points every night and expect to be successful.
Yeah, somebody else has to step up there in Dallas. And World B, does anyone come to mind as far as looking at that box score, taking a look at that game, and who are some guys that got to step up on that team to help with the point production?
Well, there's nobody else really in the starting lineup. I mean, P.J. Washington had 11 points, so you know you're going to get – that's about what you're going to get from him. If you get more than that, you feel like you achieved something. But there's no real other scoring. Derek Jones, Daniel Gafford, there's nothing really there that jumps out. You like to see their bench be a little more productive. I mean, Tim Hardaway Jr. had, you know, 6 points, just – but he only took two threes. That's not – you know, he's your three-point specialist. You want him to be that guy there. Yeah, I think if you're Dallas, you're looking at this game going, all right, we just had an off night offensively, because you're not going to – now, you know, are you going to get that many off nights the rest of the series? Because if you do, then, yeah, it's over. They played pretty good defense for the most part, only gave up 109 points. But, the game was so over so quickly, you know, the Clippers used a lot of – you know, put the foot off the gas of sorts. So – I don't expect Dallas's offense to be this bad the rest of the series. If they do, yes, it'll be a short series. I know Bruce is right. Luka and Kyrie can't carry the entire offense alone, but I look at these guys going, I don't know anybody else who can step up for him unless you can get 15 to 18 from PJ Washington. He's capable. I mean, he only made 4 of 10 in game one. But he is capable, but that's really it. Unless Tim Hardaway decides to take more than a couple of threes.
Yeah, that was going to be my guy. I think Tim Hardaway has to find one of those hot stretches that he can go through from time to time. He's never really consistently put it together for a full season, but when he gets hot, he gets red hot. And boy, could they use it right about now.
Hey, Ross, one quick note of irony, okay?
Okay.
All season long, Kawhi Leonard was healthy. He played more games. And now the first game of the playoffs, he's out. It's like, just thought that was kind of weird.
Well, he missed the last 5 or 6 of the regular season, too.
Did he miss that many? I didn't realize so it was that many.
This is a carryover for – but you're right. He had been playing – we've been asking for him to play this, you know, all season, not take the load management, you know, silliness, whatever, and he played a lot of back-to-backs, or you know, this season. We were surprised by that, but he's also, you know, a pending free agent too, or an opt-out candidate after this season. So he was going to get as much opportunity to be on the court as possible. So that being said, if he's not playing, I don't think he's in good health standing at this point.
And speaking of weird, Bruce, I thought it was weird that you failed to mention James Harden's stat line and you didn't mention he had 2 blocks. You didn't bring up that great defense that he had, you know.
Wow. You know why I didn't do that?
That was a team lead in blocks. Team lead.
The reason I didn't do that is because I'm so used to not even looking in that column when I look at their box score.
Nice.
But that's an oversight on my part. Sorry, Beard.
Yeah. All right. Moving right along here to Phoenix and Minnesota, a game that we had done on 48 Minutes Live on Playback, which was a lot of fun. Timberwolves, though, stomped out to an early lead with a 1-0 series win, 120-95, and a statement win at home. We had some chirping going back and forth between Anthony Edwards and Kevin Durant, and Bruce, World Beer and I were watching that game on 48 Minutes Live. We couldn't see Devin Booker out there. Did you see him by chance?
No, I think he's on the side of a milk carton right about now. Only 5 out of 17 from the floor. KD managed 31, but was a minus 20. So his points didn't really lead to a whole lot. I thought one of the big differences in the game was just that Yusuf Nurkic was completely dominated by the Wolves' bigs. I mean, he had 9 points. He had 4 rebounds. Gobert, Cat, and Nasreed were all in double figures. And Nurkic's help, Bol Bol and Drew Eubanks, they were invisible in their 13 combined minutes. 0 points and 2 rebounds. So I had the Suns winning this series in 6, and it certainly is still possible. We'll see. But look, the Wolves absolutely crushed Phoenix on the boards, 52-28. And unless that gets much closer, this series might not go past 5 with Minnesota winning it.
Yeah, no question about that. And World B, obviously one of the big keys in this series outside of just Anthony Edwards is the defensive end of the floor for Jaden McDaniels, who's got some tough assignments with all the offensive star power with Phoenix. What's your big takeaway from what you saw from Minnesota and McDaniels defensively?
Well, you're right. He gets the tough assignments there. So he doesn't have just the one guy either, as we know, to guard. He's on multiple guys. Minnesota, the best defensive team in the league, and they showed just that in game one. You hold a team like the Suns under 100 points, and you know they just dominated, as Bruce mentioned, dominated the glass. They dominated the defensive glass, too. I mean, Phoenix only had 3 offensive rebounds, as bad as they shot, 44% from the field, and you only get 3 offensive rebounds. That's doing the job at Minnesota's end, taking care of business there. If you're Phoenix, you're looking at this going, we're not going to have Devin Booker be this bad the whole series. If it is, it's going to be a short series. It's that that simple. Kevin Durant needs help. He had about the quietest 31 points you'd ever see him have, because it didn't factor into anything. It didn't it didn't matter. In the second and third quarters, they got blown away, 65-44. I mean, that's where the game was over. And they didn't have an answer for Anthony Edwards. So if you're Phoenix, you're going, all right, Minnesota is not going to be this great offensively, and we're not going to be this bad offensively. We have to improve in that area. Devin Booker, I would expect in game 2 to come out and have a much better performance. Certainly going to need it if they want to win. If they want to get one in Minnesota, they have to get one in Minnesota at some point in this series. So game 2s are usually a good setup for that, and a lot of improvement. Let's see these, Frank Vogel, let's see you make the adjustment that you need. Chris Finch, let's see you keep this pressure on there. But this is on Phoenix right now. Where do we get our offense? How do we get help for Kevin Durant for game 2? And how do we gotta outscore these guys? We're not gonna hold them down. Our defense is not that good. So how do we get enough points to outscore them? They have the firepower. How do we do it?
So when they got Royce O'Neal, I thought that was going to be a really big, get for those guys. I mean, does he need to just forget about any scoring responsibility at all and just stick to Anthony Edwards like Dante DiVincenzo was sticking to guys on Monday night? Just move his feet, try and just, make him uncomfortable, because Anthony Edwards was a total stud in game 1. The only negative to anything he did was the fact that he did have 6 turnovers, but he was the best player on the court.
Yeah, I think that definitely they need to have someone on assignment for Anthony Edwards and just stick it on him. Don't worry about offense. Just fully keep your energy on the defensive end. But that's a tall task, because obviously Anthony Edwards is one of the biggest rising stars in the NBA. So
the problem is, to Bruce's point, the problem is, from Phoenix's standpoint, Monday night or game 1, I'm sorry, they didn't have anybody else that was as good offensively, but at least from the perimeter, than Royce O'Neal. He goes 4 of 8 from 3. The rest of the team is 5 for 20 from downtown. If nobody else is going to step up, they need his scoring just to stay competitive along with his defense. I agree with you, Bruce. You'd rather have him be a defender and just focus on that and try to slow down some of the guys from Minnesota. But if nobody else is going to step up offensively, they're in real trouble. How bad would that game have been the other night without him hitting 4 threes and coming up with 14 points off the bench and just, in 26 minutes. So, They unfortunately, they needed his offense at the moment.
Yep, that's going to be a big game too for the Phoenix Suns. We'll see how they respond after a devastating game one loss to Minnesota, just really getting pounded from start to finish in that one. Now, the LA Lakers and Denver Nuggets is the last game that I wanted to touch on here tonight. Looking here to see where we're at on the scoreboard. Of course, Denver took game one, but World B, I'll start with you on this one. Denver might have won game one, but it certainly wasn't a cakewalk.
No, it wasn't a cakewalk. Then, you know, they got down by 12 real quick. And it was really, you know, the third quarter that was a big deal. They outscored them 32-18. They did it at both ends. They didn't make any mistakes. No turnovers for the Nuggets in that third quarter, and forced the Lakers into, you know, three, and they had more turnovers than 3-point field goals the Lakers did in that quarter. That's really where it ended for them, for the Lakers, their chances. So yeah, it wasn't the best performance from Denver in game one. Now, I don't think there's any reason to panic, but you know, they certainly got to play a little bit better in this series, because at the end of the day, the Lakers got all they could get from Anthony Davis and LeBron James. I mean, those guys stepped up and were big time. They need, just as we've been talking throughout this podcast, they need other guys to contribute. We've been talking about it all season. The Lakers need a third guy, or they need somebody else to contribute it. And yeah, they just didn't have it in game one.
Well, in the first half of this game on Monday night, the Lakers are up by 15 at halftime. Anthony Davis has 24 points at halftime, but perhaps even more importantly, D'Angelo Russell, 6 out of 7 shooting threes. He was 1 for 9 in game one, so he's got 18 points at the half. So they are getting it from D'Angelo Russell, at least in the first half of Monday night, as they lead by 15 as we're recording this.
Yeah, and that's big. And what really jumps off the halftime box score of that live game going on as we speak is LeBron James has 7 assists at halftime. I think he had 8 assists in all of game one. So it looks like, of course, the defense is trying to force LeBron's hand. And here early, his two side mates in D'Angelo Russell and Anthony Davis are certainly, taking the call and answering right now here in the first half. We'll see if they can keep this going well into the second half of play, because you know Denver's going to turn it on. But, boy, would this be a fun series if this is a 1-1 series going back to L.A. Really spice things up in the Western Conference.
Well, that's in any series here, when the road team gets a win, it really creates the interest, especially early on. If you can come away, how big would Philly, New York look right now if Philly could have held on for that one, you know, that victory, make that a 1-1 series. Now you go to Philly and they're rabid fans and ready to go. Now the pressure's on New York. You get that 1-1 series, you know, you get that going to the other team's home court. If Lakers hold on a win game two, now the pressure is on Denver. You're the defending champs. Can you win in LA? It's always great when you can get one of these games. Problem was, we didn't see anything close to that in game one by anybody in any series. There was nothing really competitive outside of maybe the New York Knicks and Oklahoma City there.
Yep. And with that, let's go ahead and close out the show and I'll give our one-liners. Bruce, I'll start with you.
Thanks, Ross. On Saturday, we lost a giant in the sports TV business with the passing of ESPN's original research guru, Howie Schwab. There have been many words of praise about this humble genius, but every sports fan who's ever watched ESPN owes him a debt of gratitude. He was best known for his starring role on Stump the Schwab, the ESPN show where he competed against contestants in the early 2000s in trivia contests. He loved college hoop, and he was Dick Vitale's go-to guy. In fact, I'd even call him Dick Vitale's spirit animal for decades, even after leaving ESPN in 2013. Howie was a dedicated husband, brother, and friend. His loyalty was legendary. So rest easy, Howie. We'll never forget you. And I know, World B, you had your moments with Howie over the years.
Absolutely. A wonderful man, a great guy. I saw him during the fall down here in Florida at a Florida Atlantic football game. And I got to take a picture with him and another former researcher. It's one of the memories I treasure with him. I really felt great that day, getting to see him, and I was absolutely saddened by his passing over the weekend.
Yeah, our thoughts and prayers go out to his family, and I'll certainly always remember that fun show. World B?
Yeah, thank you, Ross. We had the NBA released its finalists for all its postseason awards on there, and there weren't really any disputes about who the final three were in every category. I just found it interesting that the team that was the most dominant this season, that had one of the best regular seasons in the last 25 years in the NBA, the Boston Celtics, did not have one finalist in all of these categories. Now, I understand that because they were so dominant, because they had so many great players, that perhaps a lot more was expected of them. And I get that, and that's fair. I personally would have liked to have seen a coach like Joe Mazzulla be at least a finalist for one of these awards, and people would say, well, he has all this talent, and he's supposed to do that. And that's fair, but I would also counter by saying, you know, Minnesota has two number one overall picks on its roster and the defensive player of the year candidate who has won in the past on its roster. Chris Finch is not exactly playing with you know, a bunch of CBA players or G League players either. He's got some talent too. So I found it interesting that the best team in the league, which is usually how it is, did not seem to have any finalists in this year's postseason awards.
Yeah, I think that's very strange and well thought out there, will be. As for my one-liner here, Malik Monk is as good as gone following the Kings play-in tournament loss to the New Orleans Pelicans. Team leader De'Aaron Fox further echoed that thought. Unless the Sacramento Kings can pull a rabbit out of the hat, I think we ought to monitor Monk's offensive magic elsewhere next season. And yes, this is wordplay at its finest, and I'm staring right at the Orlando Magic because maybe with Malik Monk, you'd crack 100 points in a playoff game. And with that, that will do it for this edition of the 48 Minutes Podcast on Believe, presented by Bet Online. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back with you next week to be sure you're up to date in 48 on all things around the association. Take care, everyone.